and welcome back to the MJA podcast. My name is Kate Swanell, and I'm the Journal's news and online editor. Today, the topic is playground equipment. Not our usual fare, I know, but I'm going to be talking with Dr. Lisa Sharwood, an injury epidemiologist and a member of the Australian Standards Committee for Playground Safety, about the grey areas of safety standards and what role doctors can take in making child's play safer. Lisa Sharwood is my special guest today. So what prompted you to write this article? What was the Kickstarter for it?
Certainly, that's a great question, Kate. We decided to write this article after the release of some fairly public media information about the closure of this slide, or actually the entire playground was closed in northwestern Sydney, the Hilltop slide at Schofield. That was a very fantastic looking slide. I was a bit disappointed because I was really keen to try it. However, and we were aware in our discussions among the committee, the Australian Standards Committee for Playground Safety, that this particular playground had actually passed the appropriate Australian standard for playground safety, which we only just released and published the updated version of late last year. The park had passed the standard and then opened and had a lot of community interest. Yep. And people were flocking to this fantastic looking contraption, and then all of a sudden the spate of injuries occurred. So the correct response was to promptly close that park. However, that really did create an uproar about, oh my gosh, how does this happen? How can we say that this passed the standard and people are having serious injuries? So I guess from our professional perspective, we decided to really try and address that concern and, you know, give a little bit more information, because there is a lot of misconceptions.
Sure. Now, just to clarify, that slide is bigger than you would expect it to be, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And that one thing that we stress in this article, that innovation will always go ahead of the standard. You know, engineering designers, playground designers, people wanting to come up with something new and fabulous will invariably be ahead of the standard, come up with something new. So, yes, it's taller, it's bigger, it's longer. The descent and the angulation is about 30 degrees, which is probably a fairly good ski slope. And despite passing the regulations as they were written, it clearly did not protect occupants in a way that that kind of park or that kind of attraction should.
What's the line between a playground piece of equipment and, say, an adventure ride? Where does that line exist?
That's a really good question, and this is why we've suggested that this park in particular probably fits in the middle, because the line is that there is no line. It's determined by the intended use. And so clearly an attraction park, such as the many attraction parks on the Gold Coast and that sort of thing, are named and established as such, and therefore their rides and attractions within those attraction parks clearly fall outside the playground standard because it's not a public playground. However, where you can put a piece of intended play equipment in a public space that's designed as a public park, the grey area is the fact that you can certify a park and a piece of playground equipment under one particular standard where it actually could possibly be considered under another standard. It's not purpose specific to fit under that other standard. So we've certainly recommended that there perhaps be some interim standard or some intermediary position whereby certifiers and playground designers and the like have to be called to account. Unfortunately, because standards are not mandatory unless they're called into account by legislation, they're entirely voluntary, and unless a council or a playground owner or someone like Stocklands, who designed this he installed this Hilltop playground, unless they have in their contract a necessity to adhere to a particular standard, then it's really only voluntary. And for example, in this park, there were so many injuries that occurred in a short space of time that it really got a lot of momentum and a lot of media attention. However, injuries will occur at playgrounds all the time, and nobody says anything, and everybody thinks that somebody else will do something, and it just kind of goes by the by, whereas particularly sitting on a standards committee and writing standards, there could be better information for us to say, well, what is actually causing the injuries? What is the incidence of the injuries? Where are they happening? What type of venues? What type of risk? And then how do we best address the standard and the writing of the standard to mitigate that risk?
And how do you then make people follow that standard if it's not mandatory?
Absolutely. And we're seeing the same thing. I published a piece earlier this year on indoor trampoline park injuries with David and with the same co-authors plus a couple. And that's exactly the same issue where there actually wasn't a standard for indoor playground, indoor trampoline park. And it was a business venture. Somebody got this fabulous idea about putting trampoline parks indoors, predominantly in Western Sydney, because there's a lot more space, with no Australian standard, cheaper products, all that kind of thing. Let's charge a price and give kids something to do in the holidays. And the attention to what should be necessary safety requirements wasn't mandated in any sort of way. There was no voluntary standard. So Australian standards actually had to end up setting up a new standards committee. So, and that standard hasn't even been published. So we're talking about years down the track. The first indoor trampoline park was opened in 2012. So these things move
really slowly, yeah.
And very often take somebody like us, for example, to say, hang on a minute, where are the injuries happening? What's going on? Let's do some studies. Can we get data? Oh, there's not really a lot of data. I mean, that paper that we published was really only a very rough snapshot of what was happening around the country, because injury surveillance data is not available across every state. So we had a look at that, published some data. Thank goodness it got a lot of media attention, but the standard still isn't even published and people are still having injuries, including really severe injuries. So this is the same sort of thing. You can design a park and get people to go, but it doesn't necessarily mean that all the right pieces are in place. And we're encouraging parents and caregivers and doctors and nurses in emergency departments and GPs seeing injuries, all of the people who have a part to play, to actually recognise their role in that picture.
Do you want these things to be mandatory?
Oh, I would love them to be mandatory. however, there's enough complaint about the nanny state. unfortunately, I mean, I've worked in road safety for years and injury prevention for years, and we know for a fact that injury prevention strategies work best with enforcement. You can put 1,000 gory television ads about road safety and dangers of texting while you're driving. You can talk till the cows come home about injury prevention strategies and tell people they shouldn't do things. But until you enforce it in the law and apply a consequence, it actually doesn't have the same effect, because there'll always be a workaround. Swimming pool fences is a fantastic example. It's a good idea if you're going to put a pool in your backyard to have a fence around it, because then you prevent accidents from happening. People didn't want to do it because it doesn't look as pretty. it's an extra cost. All that sort of thing. Oh, and I'm sure nothing like that will happen in my backyard. And lo and behold, it does. You put it in the law and look at the rates of drowning in private swimming pools, in backyard swimming pools, has gone down directly as a result of the enforcement and litigation as a result of that. And there are still people finding workarounds. The main message is, until you make something mandatory, until you enforce it and apply consequences as a result of that, it actually doesn't have as strong as an effect as you really want it to.
I'm chatting today with injury epidemiologist Dr. Lisa Sharwood. Lisa and her co-authors have written a perspective which is published in the journal. You can find it at mja.com.au.
I think the innate nature of human beings is to push the boundaries. And we're not suggesting that we should stop children doing that. It was the same as all the discussions about trampoline parks. Oh, you know, you're just going to be the fun police. You don't want kids to do anything. And I said, absolutely not. I will take my children to play. Like I said, this slide looked fabulous. Yeah. I would love to go. Get the kids off the couch, off their iPads, out of the television, get them active, doing fun things. Risk-taking is an essential feature of play provision, but it's getting that balance. And also actually finding people who really care about it, because I think in this day and age and in the future, there are so many competing demands, a whole generational shift of working parents and who's actually looking after the kids and what's dangerous and what isn't. And there's a certain amount of all of that responsibility that just gets let go. I did a presentation on injury prevention in my son's classroom, and we talked about, you know, thinking before you take the risk and surveillance and safety and all that sort of thing. And then that was the end of the session. And so we all went out into the playground, and there'd been somebody who'd broken a glass, and there was a whole lot of safety cones around this broken glass. Two of the boys just promptly walked into the middle of the danger zone. Promptly. And, like, and I just thought, you've literally just come out of a session where I've talked about all of this and I've put the gory pictures up and I've, you know, 10-year-old boys, what can you do?
No, nothing.
So they're just going to do it. I think that's where often uproar doesn't occur until the dangerous injury happens, until after the fact.
If you had a magic wand, Lisa, what would you fix first?
I do think in this type of arena, as I said, working in injury and injury prevention and safety for so many years, I would slow down the process of getting some of this stuff out there, like the indoor trampoline parks, without having to have a serious surveillance before that happens. Look at vehicle safety, for example. Vehicles now have to go through a really rigorous safety and NCAP rating before they're allowed to be released on the road, before we're allowed to put kids in them. Why can't that occur across other arenas of activities which we like to accept as an essential part of life? Play is really important. It's vital. Playgrounds are really important. We would hate to have an environment where there was no playgrounds, but somehow, even though this park did pass the standard, it seems as though perhaps there's just not enough rigor and attention before some of this stuff becomes available. Did somebody push that through without thinking, hang on a second, do we actually need it? It's a 40-metre high, 30-metre long slide. If that was in a water park, there would be somebody standing at the top checking that riders were the correct height and had the correct clothing, footwear, one at a time, not sitting on Johnny, not, you know, all of that kind of stuff. Yeah. Or did it go through some testing? You know, we crash test vehicles before they're released into the market. Maybe we should crash test parts. There are certain engineering constraints within the standard that the park is assessed by. You know, where do you draw the line, I guess? I think some of the governance and surveillance is a little bit behind the eight ball, perhaps.
In your paper, you make a couple of recommendations. One is perhaps an interim standard between playgrounds and adventure rides. And the other one is about surveillance of injuries. Talk to us a little bit about that. What do you think should be happening when a kid gets injured on a playground?
In emergency departments, it's a really busy place. Yep. You've got injuries coming in all the time. It's not necessarily the first thing you might think of when you are treating somebody with an injury, but looking at the bigger picture, let's kind of helicopter up above the emergency department and above that injury of one and try and keep, so I'm speaking to the practitioners who are practicing in that space and doing a fantastic job. There is requisite responsibility, I think, that comes with that to ask some questions and tell someone. If you think, wow, you know, I wonder how they, you know, like Johnny comes in, he's fallen off the slide. Oh, okay, let's fix your broken leg or we'll do this and we'll do that. Can you stop for a minute and say, is my documentation going to assist somebody coding this medical record to the location of the injury, like the incident location?
Yep.
The fall height, for example, the any other specific information. The ICD-10 dictionary, which is hopefully being upgraded soon to ICD-11, and it will have, the injury chapter is going to be significantly expanded to what it is now, which will be fantastic. Even until that point in time, the fields that you can fill in as a medical coder to do with injury surveillance, more often than not, are classified as non-specific, not enough information. And I've looked at a lot of injury data, and I just published a paper on workplace injury. We couldn't get enough information out of those activity fields because it wasn't there. The medical coders can only code it if it's there. So that's within the ICD-10. Some states in Australia collect good injury surveillance data. Victoria actually is probably the only one, the only state who is consistently collecting at the triage point fields that mandate, as a triage nurse, you have to fill out those fields about the injury surveillance. Therefore, that data is managed by the Monash University Injury Unit, mm-hmm. Injury Surveillance, and you can publicly get that data. So as a researcher, as an injury epidemiologist, I want to be able to get that data all around Australia. I would love, actually, go back to the magic wand, I would love that every emergency department in the country records accurately a certain set of injury surveillance fields mm-hmm. so that as researchers we can get access to that data and really more accurately describe what's happening so that you can then get some policy or look at prevention measures. I mean, ideally you start with prevention before the accident happens, but once it's happened, you want to know more information about it. Doctors doing their medical notes, are they writing enough information in those notes to give the medical coder enough to fill out them all the relevant fields within the ICD-10 that will give somebody enough information about the activity being undertaken during that injury, the location, if it's a workplace injury, for example, the industry within that, you know, within which that person was working, all of those things are gold. They're absolute gold. And I would bet you $1 million that the clinicians are either not informed about that or just not, it's just not on their radar. The reason it may not be on their radar is because we're not telling them.
Is there an argument for having a medical coder in an emergency room doing the job so the doctors and the triage nurses don't have to do it?
That's a really creative idea. I love it. I love your idea.
There you go. Kate Swanell, innovator.
Innovator, that's another one for the magic wand. And in the order of things, ABC, documentation unfortunately is not D. It's a long way down. Take the coder and get them to do an information session with the doctors in the ED, for example, and say, you know, do you realise that if you just wrote this, it would really help us to more effectively code these cases, but not only guide future practitioners to understand the history of the patient, but it will guide the accuracy of that documentation.
You can't improve safety if you don't know where the danger is.
No, exactly. And that's what a take-home message, as I said, it's not only about documentation, it's mm-hmm. also about people who are on the ground noticing that something might have happened that maybe shouldn't have happened, doing something about it. Even take 2 minutes and call the local council or call the local office of fair trading. There are incidents that should be reported. If more people are doing that kind of thing and asking questions, has anybody looked at this? Do you know that these things are happening? Are you aware? And try and at least get the message out that there is a responsibility all the way along the chain. I think we can have a more powerful voice by all parts of the chain speaking together.
Thanks for your time, Lisa. I really appreciate it.
That's okay, no worries.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.